Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 1965, 5 years after Nigeria gained its independence, the playwright Wole Soyinka was already known as an opposition figure. Authorities falsely accused him of armed robbery. And before the country's civil war of the late 60s, Soyinka tried to avert fighting. He was accused of conspiring with rebels and was then imprisoned by the Nigerian government. He's a writer with an astonishing history of putting himself on the line for his political and social commitments. Soyinka has received the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's written more than 24 plays, a vast amount of poetry, several memoirs, essays, and short stories, and just 2 novels. His third novel is out now, nearly 5 decades after the last one. It's called Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth. It's both a political satire and a murder mystery. It involves 4 friends, a secret society dealing in human body parts, and more corruption than any one country can bear. Staff writer Vincent Cunningham spoke to Wole Soyinka at his home in Nigeria.
I really want to talk to you about Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth, a title that I love. I heard that you've been thinking about this story for many years now. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
It's been a little bit overwhelming, I think. I wasn't expecting this kind of reception of it. For me, it's just part of my own creative continuum in a different format. You know, it's like taking time off from theater to write a novel.
Yeah. This is your third novel. And of course, you're known most prolifically for your works of theater. But what is it that the novel does for you that theater does it? This change in form, are there necessities that it meets that theater doesn't, and vice versa? What's the form about for you?
What the novel does for me as a medium of expression is to assuage the masochist in me. Because the novel is very taxing. Taxing in the sense that it's tempting to go in so many directions. Theater, for me, is more focused. When you're a narrator and you're juggling a number of characters and they insist on wandering in very willfully in directions which you did not preview, you know, and then you forget where you last saw them and so on. You know, I really praise novelists, those whose métier is a novel. They have a hard time at it.
Yeah, I mean, but you do in this way, and it's interesting to hear you talk about them as in some ways willing themselves, but you offer us this total panoply of great characters. There's a crooked religious leader, there are the politicians, a sort of earnest diplomat, a famous doctor. Did you, in the course of writing this book, was there a favorite character that you aligned on? Was there one who was especially willful and sort of surprised you in different ways?
Well, there's no question at all that a number of the characters were, quote-unquote, inspired or triggered into being by personal encounters. I took great pains to ensure that some of the villains knew that they provided the base material. And in fact, I've even met one of them since the novel came out. And it came up to me and I said, well, you're coming to me. I hope you realize that you were this in the novel. And it was a politician. And like a good politician, said, oh, prof, that's okay. But I really want to discuss a certain issue with you in the novel. Forget my character. But so the novel does give one that latitude, I must confess. And then you can play variations far more than in theater. I think theater is almost pre-written. By that I mean they are more constricted in case of the theater. And that is one of the reasons why tackling a theme like this human tumult in which I've been existing, watching others survive, me to surviving in my own way, watching that deterioration of society, the novel intuitively struck me as the only medium in which I could actually purge myself of this oppressive sense of a society going haywire.
It's interesting. There is this sense, this dark sense of a, as you say, a society going haywire, and it's contrasted against this wonderful title, you know, the land of the happiest people on earth. Now, I heard that this was inspired by the quote unquote World Happiness Report, where Nigeria was rated one of the happiest countries in the world. First of all, is that true? And what did that reality, if so, what did that present to you artistically?
Well, when I saw that that world report, I thought, look at these people laughing at us. Why are they so cruel? Why are they doing this? Yeah. And then I realized it was supposed to be a serious poll, a serious estimate, supposed to be objective, analytical, even scientific.
Yeah.
And so I looked into this. I said, maybe I'm in the wrong place. But when I looked around, it was still a society which I recognized as my own, as the one in which I functioned. So it stuck in my head for quite a while. This was some years ago. And when I began working on it, it actually began with other titles. Eventually, I suddenly realized, oh, wait a minute, that estimation, that analysis is the exact title I've been looking for.
You know, happiness is such a fraught idea. Here in America, of course, we've sort of encoded it into our national myth. You know, the pursuit of happiness has all these echoes.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah.
What does it mean for you? Because, of course, it can be totally vapid, fun-seeking, surface sort of Epicureanism, I guess. But it can also speak to a real joy. What does it mean for you, and why did it fit so well?
It fits so well, of course, because it's an irony. This country, the people in this nation, are not the happiest by no strength of the imagination. And yet, at the same time, if they went deep enough in society, I think they would flee or consign this nation to the place to be during your, what's that season of yours when you hang skeletons all over the place?
Halloween.
November. Halloween. Halloween. Maybe this is Halloween Nation.
Yeah.
And then one can understand it.
Right, right.
But then again, as I was saying, you do encounter those who extract forcibly a measure of contentment, of fulfillment, even of the most meager kind. They're buoyed either by religion or by an ingrained traditional philosophy that the worst is yet to come, and therefore you better enjoy the present. Because Nigerians do celebrate. I mean, that is not a lie. And those people all over the world where Nigerians are, they do salute Nigerians for their spirit of celebration, which is why I took pains to ensure that at least one character represented what the pursuit of happiness might be. Through creativity, through just love of others, through just making others happy, if only for a few moments. So it's a mishmash of ironies, of acknowledgments, of concession, of even a measure of salute to the people. I hope that measure comes out, that element comes out.
Staff writer Vincent Cunningham speaking with Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka. More to come.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
Speaking of this issue of happiness and the different places where it can be found or not found, you know, where it can be promised but not delivered, perhaps, one of those is religion. And a lot of this book turns on a kind of an upswing in religious fundamentalism. Is it okay if I read a very short passage that I just love from this book? It's about a preacher who we get to know better on. His name is Papa Divina. And he has this epiphany. He's on this kind of long comic journey across West Africa. We see him in Liberia, Senegal, Sierra Leone. And he's in Ghana and he has this epiphany. He's just kind of made this pun on the word a site of prophecy or prophet site. And he says this. He looked nervously around, hoping that no one else had caught that creative slip, or at least that it had not registered with anyone in that audience with apostolic ambitions. The flash momentarily unnerved him, as it inserted profound doubts in his mind. Could it be that he was, after all, the genuine article? That he had indeed responded to an authentic call to prophecy? Prophesite. Why had all his predecessors failed to formulate such an exquisite, indeed mellifluous name for a place of spiritual quest? Could it be that he was, unbeknownst to himself till now, truly called? This person who's clearly a charlatan of a kind, but almost convinces himself that he's not in certain ways. I wanted to talk to you just about this emphasis on fundamentalism. What role did that play for you?
You know, some of the greatest charlatans of religion, of the religious profession, yeah, are really very likable people, very lovable people. First of all, they're performers. They enjoy performing. Now, if you enjoy what you're doing, you're a happy person and you infect others with some of that happiness. So even while you are, you know, blathering pietitudes and knowing very well that you are conning your congregation, mm-hmm, you do produce not just happiness, sometimes rapture, genuine, authentic rapture. And so I find very complex people, the genuine religionists. Of course, some of them are just sinister, the fundamentalists, for instance, both of Christianity and of Islam Hinduism, for instance. You have the fundamentalists. All religions have their fundamentalist sectors, and those are really sinister, dangerous people. They have no sense of humor. They cannot see the pathetic side of life. Hmm. They cannot even look at themselves in the mirror and give themselves a pat on the back and say, "You charlatan, but today wasn't bad." You know, they're incapable of it.
Yeah.
They just, some of them just kill. They believe that's it. You kill anybody who doesn't aspire to your level of malevolent conviction. Hmm.
I'd love to talk to you about, you know, over the course of your career, and I feel career is not as capacious a word as I want, you've been able to bring your activism and your intellectualism and your sort of art all onto the same plane, all operating at once. I learned that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is Fela Kuti your cousin?
Fela.
Yes.
Yes, my cousin, Anikulakwo. Yes, of course, yes.
I had not known that, and it struck me as so apt because here was another person whose art and intellect and political sense were all inter-implicated all together. I wonder if just your upbringing made you feel that as a responsibility. Was that a natural step for you to be sort of an activist, politically aware, a true citizen in the deep sense of that word, and also an artist at the same time?
It remains a mystery to me. And why should it be a mystery? It's because, basically, I would rather not be all these things. In other words, an activist. Ask myself, I don't know how often, how on earth did you get on this path? Why don't you just stick to what you love, really love doing?
Yeah.
Just writing bits of poetry, writing plays, directing plays, exchanging ideas, getting into arguments simply because we live also with abstractions. And anybody who believes in the essence of things, the theory of things, loves the discourse about them. And this I enjoy, which is also why I'm also a teacher by profession. I would rather be doing all those things, honestly. But I end up using that expression a closet masochist for myself because I'm doing certain things which I know I would rather not be doing. But I also love my peace of mind, my tranquility, and I cannot attain that. That's a contradiction. I know I cannot attain that if I have not attended to an issue, a problem, which I know is pernicious, which I know is manifesting itself in a dehumanizing way in others, whether human beings, environment, child abuse, for instance. So we're not just talking about politics.
Right.
We're just talking about humanity. This is one of me. I remain restless when I see such situations. And the only way I can attain that peace, which I love so much, and which I only very sparsely enjoy, that's what drives one out again and again and again, using other means when one's literature fails one, fails to address the issue. Then, of course, you have to address it frontally, physically, by whatever means.
Yeah. I love how you just said that your pursuit of tranquility has, in some ways, required that you get yourself into trouble in these other ways. You know, it seems like there's not much glory to be had among your own people when you are confronting them in this way. It seems like a fraught position. Just on a personal level, have you made peace with that, or is it a constant?
It's a constant. If I am to be at peace with myself, I must confront the unacceptable from whichever side. Of course, the state has certain statutory responsibilities, so the state gets it more than the people themselves.
I love a quote in your book. There are two friends who really form the heart of this book who are speaking at one point, and one of them delivers one of the book's most affecting lines for me. He says, "Something is broken beyond race, outside color or history. Something has cracked, can't be put back together." That's something, that sort of ineffable something that's beyond all of the ideology and all of anything that we can put our finger to. I wonder if writing this book helped you put a name to that ineffable something, and have maybe the politics of the last few years helped you to identify or reconsider what it might be.
You know, I've tried to put my finger on it, and I end up with the question, what is human? And I think that's what we've lost. It has gone on for too long, that condition of losing what is human. From the most profound aspects of our relationships to the most trivial, we lost what is human.
As a way to say goodbye, we mentioned Fela Kuti, your late cousin. Do you have a favorite song of his?
My favorite is Zombie. The reason, actually, is one that's not appreciated by most people. That song, Zombie, applies not merely to the military in terms of their conduct to the people in this nation, but Zombie, and that is what Nigerians have not yet realized, they have become mimic people. They act like zombies. They expect orders, even if those orders are intolerable. They develop habits that they should not develop. So when I hear Zombie, I see not merely SARS, those murdering police. I see not merely the bullying soldiers. I see also what Nigerians have become. So I enjoy Zombie on many more levels than the average Nigerian does.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful, and I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Staff writer Vincent Cunningham speaking with Nobel laureate Wally Soyinka. His new novel is Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth. And that's it for us this week. And if you missed anything from today's program, you can find it all on the podcast of our show, wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Priscilla Alabi and Harrison Heathline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.